The New York Times once ran an editorial entitled The Truth, which I share with you. The truth is hard. The truth is hidden. The truth must be pursued. The truth is hard to bear. The truth is rarely simple. The truth isn't so obvious. The truth is necessary. The truth can't be glossed over. The truth has no agenda. The truth can't be manufactured. The truth does not take sides. The truth isn't red or blue. The truth is hard to accept. The truth pulls no punches. The truth is powerful. The truth is under attack. The truth is worth defending. The truth requires taking a stand. And the last one, the truth is more important than ever. Here endeth the reading of the editorial from the New York Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you today. It's been a couple of years since I was a pulpit guest, and it's nice to be back. It's always a pleasure to come and be with the friends and the members of the Unitarian Church in Barnstable. In 1978, Harvard philosopher Cicela Bock, wife of the then president of Harvard, Derek Bock, established herself as a thinker of renown with the publication of her first major book, Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, which won the Orwell Award. Well, her book was held in such high regard that it was reissued in 1988 and again in 1999. And it is, in the opinion of many, the only comprehensive book of any worth on that topic. And it continues to be used in philosophy and ethics courses all around the globe. Well, we had the pleasure of her speaking at a lecture series in my former church in Norwell sometime in the late 80s or 90s. And I distinctly recall referring to her book on lying in a sermon that I did during the period of the Clinton presidency. Apparently, it is never too early or late to deal with that issue in the public arena, regardless of the political party involved. So here we are in 2018, and S. Bock's book is more relevant than ever. Well, We have only to turn to children's literature to realize how important this issue has always been and still is in our life and culture. Take the story of Pinocchio, for example. I remember going to see Disney's cartoon version sometime in 1979 with my then 8-year-old daughter, Jennifer. And I can still recall the scene where Pinocchio dares to lie to the good fairy who had animated his wooden body with life. Well, his nose, as you remember, began to grow and grow and grow and grow to such lengths that branches and leaves sprouted at the end and birds built a nest in it. What a potent image to threaten potential young liars and to underscore the importance of being truthful to your all-wise and loving elders, who, of course, always tell the truth and never resort to deception in their public or their private lives. Would that it were true. Pinocchio, you might say, is the mythical opposite of the legendary tale by Parson Weems of George Washington as a young boy who, you remember, chops the bark off his father's favorite cherry tree, and when asked about it by his father, confesses, "I cannot tell a lie. I did it with my little hatchet," which he had received as a gift from his father. Well, his father then praises him for telling the truth. The legend about Washington shows the reverence of his character by his countrymen, both then and now. George Washington was the first president of the United States and a politician, you might say, in the best sense of the word. He set a high standard in the minds of his countrymen for future political leaders to follow. How many, we might ask, have come close to measuring up to that standard, unrealistic though it may be? Well, not many. Let's just say that as far as the average citizen in the U.S. today is concerned, there are an awful lot of long noses down in Washington and in the state houses and the city halls of the land. It's not just national politics, it's local too, huh? We need no survey to tell us that a substantial portion of the American people believe they've been deceived and lied to by their political leaders, at least some of them, time and time again. Confidence in the veracity of political leaders and the political process itself, you might say, has been seriously undermined. Well, now we find ourselves in the midst of an ongoing controversy about truth versus lies from our current Congress and presidency or whomever. No politician wants to admit that they've just plain out lied, so they come up with euphemisms to cover up the fibs, like alternative facts. Kellyanne Conway, senior advisor to the president, came up with that one. But as Chuck Todd countered on Meet the Press, he said, "Alternative facts aren't facts. They're falsehoods." Remember the old Dragnet series with Jack Webb? Yeah, he'd question a possible suspect or witness to a crime and who would wander off the point, and then Jack Webb would reply, "Just give me the facts, ma'am. I just want the facts." He never asked for alternative facts. In today's political world, if you do not like the facts as presented, just call them fake news. Well, friends, that does not change the facts. Only how they appear to someone else who'd prefer to cover them up. You may recall one of all too many fake news episodes when President Trump denied our New York Times story about his previous intention to fire Special Investigator Robert Mueller. But he then relented when his top White House advisor threatened to resign over the issue. The president said, "Fake news, folks. Typical New York Times fake story," he said. But four other people, it turns out, corroborated that fake story. Presumably, they had good reasons to believe it was true. And now we have the latest truth versus lie from the president's former lawyer, Cohen, who says that Mr. Trump did in fact know about the Trump Tower meeting with the Russians ahead of time, while Trump vehemently denies it. Mark Peters, in a recent news column, noted that politicians and even a few lay people have been euphemizing their lies for a long, long time. And he lists some very interesting euphemisms for fudging the facts. And he lists them as follows. Taking factual shortcuts. Being economical with the truth. Truthful hyperbole. Ron Ziegler, Nixon's press secretary, said, inoperative statement. Or strategic misrepresentation. That beauty was by Winston Churchill. Strategic misrepresentation. Oh, it's this one from Churchill. Terminological inexactitude. Terminological inexactitude. We have a lot of that around these days, don't we? Mark Sanford, the former governor of South Carolina, once denied that he was lying about his adultery. He said he was just, quote, creating a fiction, unquote. Well, we didn't know he was a novelist. And late night talk host Stephen Colbert has updated his former older word, which he called truthiness, with this one, post-truth, which won the word of the year from the Oxford University Press. Post-truth. Jill Colvin from the Associated Press in a recent column says that we have a new pattern in truth-telling versus the facts. From Mr. Trump, you make a claim, and then you wait for the facts to catch up. He made a claim about immigration riots taking place in Sweden, the country of Sweden, which had not happened at the time that he said it. 2 days later, there were some immigrant riots in a suburb of Stockholm. And the president commented, "I talked about Sweden, and it may have been somewhat different, but the following 2 days later, they had a massive riot there, exactly what I was talking about." In the Bible, they call that prophecy. Or predicting the future. In psychic circles, it's called fortune telling. For President Trump and Stephen Colbert and others, we might call it running a post-truth campaign. Well, dear friends, if we have to wait for the facts to catch up to the truth, we are in deep trouble. Years ago, Phil Linsalata of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch said that the trick in modern politics is knowing how to lie well. And he quoted media consultants from both parties, Democrat and Republican campaigns, who admitted that stretching the truth and sometimes outright lying is part of the game of running for political office. They right out admitted it. They call them, quote, stretchers, unquote. And the objective is to take a half-truth or an untruth about your political opponent and stretch it and make it believable for the couch potato public. And since it takes 10 times as much verbiage to correct a political lie or distortion than it takes to say it the first time, you can make yourself look pretty good about other things while your opponent twists in the wind of the media, asking him questions he'd rather not dignify with an answer. It goes on all the time. The downside to playing the game of political stretchers is that you risk getting caught in a bald-faced lie. What makes the political lie so insidious in our day and age is that it's transmitted instantly by television or cell phone or tweeting to an audience that disappears, never again to be regrouped in quite the same way. The rebuttals never reach the same group of people who heard it, the lie in the first place. And since the lie panders to what some people want to believe, the rebuttal is often considered to be a lie. Among an increasingly cynical electorate, the response among voters becomes, "Oh, sure he lied. They all lie." And when it comes to tweeting, remember this admonition: tweet your neighbor as you would be tweeted by. A little twist of the teachings of Jesus. Well, political truth stretching, however, is only a reflection of attitudes in the larger culture. I wouldn't mind you. People cheat sometimes on their income taxes, on what they report to insurance companies when collecting a claim, or on collecting unemployment while holding down another job and getting paid under the table, or on overcharging clients for services rendered. The justification is that everyone does it, so why shouldn't I? But everyone, my friends, does not do it, and neither should we. The more who do it, however, the less we can trust one another in our social and in our personal lives and relationships. But you may be asking yourself, is all lying wrong in all circumstances? Is it ever right to lie? Would it be possible to live in a society in which nobody ever lied about anything and still be civil to one another? Wouldn't some people be honest to the point of rudeness and take pleasure in hurting people with their frank and crude opinions? What would happen to diplomacy and common courtesy and to courtship and to flattery and to tall tales of fishermen about the one that got away? Let's be honest, but no, let's not overdo it. The question is, where do you draw the line? Cicela Bach, in her most excellent book on lying, moral choice in public and private life, offers some guidelines, or what she calls ground rules, for permissible lying within the context of a general principle of truthfulness, or what she calls the principle of veracity. The principle of veracity favors truthfulness in general practice and in most situations, but it recognizes that in some rare instances, lying may be justified or even acceptable, a kind of last resort or best choice under the circumstances. And she cites the Immanuel Kantian principle of absolute truthfulness in every situation, but she recognizes that it has certain limits. There are, of course, so-called white lies that preserve the equilibrium and humaneness of social relationships. Hello, how are you? Thank you. How are you? Well, you know, generally people don't really want to know or listen to a catalog of physical and mental complaints every time they ask someone, how are you? They're just engaging in polite conversation like, good morning, and don't want or expect the other to bare their souls. And even if we are sincere, even if they are sincere in their inquiry about your state of health, you may not want to talk about your aches and your pains to all your well-meaning friends and relatives. So you reply, oh, I'm coming along just fine. Although you may be hurting in delicate places you'd rather not mention. More serious and rare are cases of extremity and crisis where a lie is told to save a life. Such a lie to a crazed killer, for example, to protect the whereabouts of the murderer's intended victim, or in times of war, lying to divert the enemy, to save the lives of the fighting men and women under one's command. Then there is lying to protect peers and clients by doctors and lawyers and even clergy. But the limits of fidelity to colleagues and clients ends where violation of conscience and potential public harm are at stake. What, for example, should a minister do, or a priest, when a pastoral counselee confesses to murdering his child, or his wife, or her husband? Should he or she, the clergy person, refuse to testify in court? Or lie to protect the sacredness and confidentiality of the confessional pastoral relationship? What should the clergy person do under those conditions? Or should they turn around and report them to the authorities and thereby violate a pledge of confidentiality? It's a difficult decision. One I'd rather not have to make. Much easier was a request I once received from a young man in college who asked me to falsify a marriage certificate so that he could live with a female companion in a married dorm at less cost. After recovering from being utterly flabbergasted by this request, I politely refused his request. Liars, warns Sisselbach, usually fail to consider two things: the harm that the lying does to the liar himself or herself in terms of violating their own integrity, and the harm done to, you might say, the general level of trust and social cooperation. Both, she says, are cumulative, and both are hard to reverse. Some level of truthfulness is essential to human society. Without it, social relations would collapse, and rational human society could not function. Well, what does lying do to the liar? It's easier, Witt observed, to tell a lie, but ever so hard to tell only one. The first lie must be thatched with another. or it will rain through. More and more lies may come to be needed. The liar always has more mending to do. It takes an excellent memory to keep one's untruths in good repair and disentangled. The sheer energy the liar has to devote to shoring them up is energy that the honest man and woman can dispose of freely. Trust and integrity, concludes Sisala Bach, are precious resources, easily squandered, and ever so hard to regain. They can thrive only on a foundation of respect or veracity. Well, the following cartoon once appeared in the New Yorker. I love this one. The scene is a cocktail party with three men having a conversation. And the caption reads as follows: "But I see no harm in living a lie. That's where the Unitarians and I part company." Well, I'd kind of like to think that the Unitarian Universalist Church is at least one place you can come and be reasonably sure that you are in the midst of a community of people who cherish truth and endeavor to live their lives based on that truth. Well, we don't always succeed, but any stretch, and sometimes we may stretch that truth to suit our own wishes and needs, but the challenge to rise above our human failures and shortcomings is always there. And we are called to do our best to live our lives based on what the Universalists used to call truth known or to be known. I love that. The truth known or to be known. In closing, I share a word of advice from Mark Twain, a working principle that will give guidance in every situation of doubt about whether to lie or tell the truth. Here's what Mark Twain said: "When in doubt, tell the truth. It will confound your enemies and astound your friends." Astound us, O God of truth, with truth noble and full of praise. Confound us in conscience until we be moved to speak, think, and live the truth in all the fullness of being. So may it be. Amen. Our closing hymn is "O Star of Truth."